I want to present this morning, the topic is the pursuit of equality. And I want to present a few historical facts, which may surprise you, and some trends that I think I can observe in recent history. But mainly, I want to push you to reflect on the meaning of what I take to be the pursuit of equality in our society today. And let me give you the conclusion. We are pursuing a goal which we have not thought about. We don't know what we're doing. And it's going to be very difficult for us to find out what we're doing because we don't really want to achieve equality. I mean by that that there is no defensible and definable sense of the word equality which we really intend to achieve. We're trying to achieve something else that I would simply call justice. And in order for a society to pursue the goal of justice, it must have some kind of an agreement on ethics. And we don't have that. I think our society, the moral consensus upon which our society was founded on the basis of which it long endured, is disintegrating. And that's a problem. All right, I want to begin with the War on Poverty, which was launched in 1964. The War on Poverty was a success. That's not often said, but it was. If you define success in the way in which it was defined in 1964, the War on Poverty succeeded. They defined poverty roughly by having nutritional experts create a nutritious diet, pricing that, and then saying nobody should spend more than a third of their income on food. And so they multiplied that by three, and that became the poverty level of income. Now notice that was an absolute level. It's adjusted every year for changes in the price level. All right, now if you use that definition of poverty, and that's what in 1964 we said we were going to eliminate, we have roughly succeeded. There are still some people who fall below that poverty line, that line defined in really physiological terms, in biological terms. But they tend to be in pockets. For example, they are recent immigrants from Mexico, or people who've gotten mixed in with recent immigrants from Mexico, or people who are in some rural backwaters who can't reach, or very elderly people cooped up in apartments. For the most part, I think it would be fair to say that they are people for whom help is available, income of some kind is available to them if they knew about it, if they could be brought in touch with it. Now, I think this is very significant. Some people say we launched a war on poverty and failed miserably. It did not fail miserably in terms of its own goals. It did not achieve those goals in the way in which we thought we were going to achieve them. If you look at our original intentions back in 1964, it was very clearly stated, we're going to do it the American way. We're not going to give people income. We're going to educate them and train them so that everybody can produce his own income. That bombed. That did not succeed. But what happened along the way is that the public got sufficiently interested in the problem of poverty that there was a kind of an explosion of welfare rights and a great expansion of entitlements. So that since 1964, when the War on Poverty was launched, we have enormously increased the liberality of all forms of transfer payments from federal, state, and local governments. Just think of Social Security, for example. Social Security benefits are much more liberal today than they were in 1964. Supplemental Security Union. It's this other kind of income that a new program was created to provide additional income to people who just needed additional income. All sorts of things. There's been a real, an enormous expansion in the amount of money that is transferred to needy people. But why then, if we won, we didn't win the way we intended to, but we did win, why does everybody run around saying the war on poverty was a failure? And I think it's because whipping poverty, defined in those absolute terms, we discovered that poverty wasn't an absolute phenomenon. Poverty is really a relative phenomenon. There have been a lot of surveys. People go into communities and they ask ordinary people, take good polling techniques, what would you consider poor? And over again, the data suggests that most Americans think somebody is poor when their income is less than about half the median income in their community. And the median is, if you lined all the people up in a row, the people in the village of Upper Worcester, you lined them all up in a row from the poorest family to the richest family, and then grabbed the middle family and said, what is your income? That would be the median income. All right. Most Americans, there's a real remarkable consensus on this, think of poverty as a level of income which is less than half of that median. Anything less than that makes it impossible for people to attain a decent standard of living. Now that's obviously a relative standpoint, so that we're not going to eliminate poverty simply by everybody getting more real income. Because if the whole distribution rises together, the same percentage of people are still going to be below the median. So what this implies is that Americans really want a redistribution of income. Now the question is, how much redistribution do they want? Well, if you ask them, they all say, well, they want to eliminate excessive inequalities. And the public is not too upset. Most citizens are not too upset by the extremes at the upper end. They are bothered by extremes at the lower end. In other words, which is, I think, kind of healthy. It's not so much envy that motivates them. It is concern for the destitute. But now here's a problem. Suppose that, well, if poverty is, and I'm now going to assume it is, a cultural phenomenon, so that you are poor not because you don't have something in relationship to what Adam and Eve had, but because you don't have enough of what the people in your community have, then is it not likely that as we squeeze the income distribution, at least squeeze it up from the bottom in order to push people up above that half the median point, which by the way is called the Fuchs point, because a guy named Victor Fuchs popularized it. If you push people, up above that question, won't the public's perception of the poverty level change? As if we define poverty in terms of what we see, then if we see something better, won't we set a higher standard for the definition of poverty? You see, how much difference among people is tolerable? I propose to you, I cannot prove this, but I think there's a good deal of evidence to support, that the reason Americans say half the median is the minimum is because of the relatively small number of people they see below half the median. If they saw more people below half the median, I think they would define it as maybe a third of the median. What I am suggesting is that our notion of a proper distribution of income is a function of what we're used to. See, it isn't merely the case that we're defining poverty in relative terms. Our relative definitions of poverty are relative. Or the way some people have put it, I said, if we squeeze the distribution of goodies to make it more equal, the remaining inequalities will become more significant. And if that's the case, we could be chasing our tail. We found out that we weren't satisfied when we just pulled people out of poverty defined physiologically. I'm suggesting that we are going to find out that as we now equalize the distribution of income, pull people out of relative poverty, we're not going to be satisfied either. The analogy that comes to my mind is the touching phenomenon. I remember when touchy-feelies first invaded the world, and they came to the campus where I was teaching, and there was a guy who he was really good at. His name was Craig, and I liked him a lot, and I don't know that he liked me, but he sure made me feel that he did. Yeah. And then he didn't make me antsy either. He just had a nice technique. I'm kind of a clutchy person. I have trouble hugging and all that. But he had a way of, you know, just sort of laying a hand on me that was support, and I felt real good after that. But then I found out something, that after three touches, I wanted a hug. You know? And I went after three hug, yoke. The thing is, you discount all this. Some people say, gee, the Italians must have a nice, intimate life. Well, I wonder if the British, with all of their reserve, don't have about as much intimacy. If you do something all the time, it's not... No, the meaning of cultural phenomena shifts. I'm really stressing the cultural definition of poverty and the cultural significance of differences. And you may quarrel with that, but I would just caution you about making intercultural comparisons in this matter, whether those intercultural comparisons are spatial or temporal. I mean, I do not think that you can, in a meaningful way, compare the income of people in the United States with the income of the people in India. The cultural differences are too great. There are some people, in fact, I saw the pamphlet around here. A colleague of mine named Morris Morris, it's a good name, has been working on some kind of what he calls a measure of welfare that is free of cultural bias. And what he uses is life expectancy and infant mortality, but then one that he admits it's not very good, but he won't drop it, literacy. And I think literacy rates are very culturally biased. But anyway, he's trying to come up with some measure of real welfare that is independent of, or is not so dependent on levels of income. And that's an interesting experiment. We need a lot more of that. But there are studies which show that levels of happiness are not correlated with levels of income. They are correlated with relative levels of income. In other words, there obviously is some level of destitution where there's misery. But for an awful lot of societies with vastly different incomes, attempts to measure degrees of satisfaction have shown that, well, you're as well off in a society where the median income is $1,000, you're as happy with $1,000 as you would be in a society where the median income is $5,000 if you had $5,000. If you are not careful about cross-cultural comparisons, I think you come to some absurdities. For example, you wind up with the conclusion that over half of the people in the richest nation in the United States were poor prior to World War II. And I think that's just absurd. At a time when the wealth of the United States was fabled, when people were migrating here from other countries because there was gold in the streets, when the people did come, and well, some people came and went back, but they came to grab some of that wealth and go back home and saw Americans as fabulously rich. To say that over 50% of our population is poor is obviously be making some kind of error. All right, now, When I said that Americans are pursuing equality, or we are interested today in reducing inequality, some people would say, well, but the American goal has always been the reduction, or creating, my wife says I should slow down. When I have a lot I want to say, I tend to talk too fast, and I'm not even listening to myself. The goal of Americans has historically been equality of opportunity. And we love to talk about that. That fits in with our ideology, you know, because everybody gets an equal chance and then we race. And those who get to the finish line get the blue ribbons and so on. Well, the trouble with that is that the problem has come to be recognized widely in connection with affirmative action programs, where we have said, well, gee whiz, you take two people, they're both 21 years old, and say, all right, you guys both have an equal chance to get into medical school. Of course, you had a crummy education, and you had a good one, but now you've got equality of opportunity. Where do you measure equality of opportunity? And you know, once you start asking that question, there's no place to stop. There is no such thing as equality of opportunity. People have different genes. They have different family experiences. In fact, you could say, and you can't disprove this, that if two people do not get to the finish line at the same time, it must have been because of some inequality of opportunity. Well, when you start thinking this way, and it seems to me to be a logical way to think, then you say, well, the only true measure of equality of opportunity is equality of outcomes. The only way we can assure that really every American had an equal opportunity is to be sure that every American gets to the finish line at the same time. We should pursue equality of results. Now, that view is not, as far as I can tell, held by a majority of Americans, but it is held by a significant number of opinion makers, people who write for the New York Times and teach at Harvard University, and it is a powerful argument, and I think it is one that in an egalitarian society, which I do believe ours is basically, a lot of people say ours isn't, but that's because, I think ours is a fundamentally egalitarian society, and I suspect that this argument that true equality of opportunity finally requires equal outcomes, or in my terms, an equal distribution of income, is an argument that is going to gain favor with the public in the years ahead. Bill?
It seems to me that by equality of opportunity we have meant that we wanted people to have the chance to enter the race equally, but not necessarily to all arrive at the outcome at the same time.
Yes, but the problem is, if they look, what is it? At what point in their life does the race begin? What age does the race begin? You tell me that. 6. But see, before they reach the age of 6, they have already been made unequal. So, you know, if you put a fat kid in a race with a skinny kid and say you have equal opportunity to win, they really don't. The fat kid has already been disadvantaged by his genes or something. If you look back.
I see that, but what I'm trying to suggest is that I think the phrase equality of opportunity has functioned with the understanding that there are some givens and that those givens include inequalities.
Well, my reading of the literature is that very little attempt, people who use the phrase equality of opportunity paid little attention to those givens. They operated with a kind of a view, let me characterize it, that all human beings were created equal. And then, two things happen. Then sometimes society steps in and disadvantages some, and that's unfair. So we must not do that. Society must give everybody an equal break. And if society gives everybody an equal break, and because everybody is born basically equal, then any differences in outcome are due to moral failings or moral virtues. At least they're morally relevant. So if one guy gets rich, another guy is poor, as long as you can demonstrate that the society didn't cheat, didn't impose artificial handicaps on one and give artificial breaks to another, you can accept those results because they are due to differences in character. Now that's, I think, the traditional American interpretation of the doctrine of equality of opportunity. Would you agree with that?
I would hope not, but you've studied it much more, and indeed it may be the case.
I'm not sure what you think is wrong with that.
I think the idea that we are all born equal in any absolute sense is one that no right-thinking person would ever try to hold today. The way in which we are
well,
born
okay. I think I agree with you. It's an idea that very few thoughtful people hold today. But I'm talking about what they held 100 years ago, or 50 years ago, or even 25 years ago. I was talking to somebody about Jane Addams, for example, of Hull House. And she's kind of interesting. When you think of Jane Addams as a progressive reformer, this comes through in her so clearly. And it really comes through in the people who were called socialist and anarchist, radical, un-American revolutionaries in the 1880s, for example, all they wanted was equality of opportunity, described as I've described it, and I think it's very clear in the case of people like T.V. Powderly and just an awful lot of William Jennings Bryan, that they felt that people were basically born equal. And the thing is, you can accept differences of outcome if you think they're somehow morally relevant. If to either perform a useful social function or they are the consequences of your own darn fault. And I think we did believe that.
How do the people who think that the outcome should be equal for everyone, how do they see this being achievable?
Well, that's what I want to get into.
I'm just saying, we've got a first grade, and already at that first grade level, those kids are in corners.
Right. Well, we've been...
It is
very, very difficult.
I was just trying to raise the question about by the sweat of thy brow thou shalt eat bread.
Okay, that's a question. I'm sure that's coming back to many of you. All right, I want to, I wanted to tell you just briefly about Christopher Jenks. Christopher Jenks is a Harvard professor who, with a number of colleagues a few years ago, published a book called Inequality, which was interesting because Jenks wanted to raise the question, what is the social and moral significance of existing inequalities of income? And so he and his colleagues used a lot of data and sophisticated statistical techniques to try to establish why some people were rich and some people were poor. And you know, they came to the conclusion that most of the differences were due to luck. It's a fascinating book, and it's well worth reading. You can sort of skim the statistical stuff, and you can assume that they're handling their statistics responsibly, although that has been questioned. I think there's a very significant, difficult statistical debate about this. Can you attribute... When there's a residual that you can't explain by any theory, can you really attribute that to luck, or should you not attribute that to something that you haven't yet thought of? One of the arguments has been, and this comes back to your sweat of your brow, that one of the things that Jenks and his colleagues did not look at was the D factor, doggedness, determination, and discipline. But some of the techniques that they use, for example, you take brothers. You'd say brothers should have an equal opportunity pretty well. I mean, if you can expect people with equal opportunities, people to have equal opportunity, I should think that looking at brothers would be a good group to look at. But what does he come up with? The expected difference in income of brothers is 6-1 or something like that. I don't know. I better be careful about quoting exact numbers. But see, his conclusion is that since it's due to luck fundamentally, and luck is morally irrelevant. If you're just lucky, you can't say, I deserved it. And moreover, he argues, luck is socially without function. There's no reason to reward luck. There may be a reason to reward for hard work, because that gets people to do hard work. But I think that second argument is questionable, because you know people have different attitudes toward risk. And if society does not reward people who are lucky, people are going to dodge activities that are risky. And that may have some very important social consequences. But I just mentioned this. Christopher Jenks has had a big impact on this whole discussion and has persuaded a lot of people that the traditional factors that we used to point to justify existing inequalities of income are of doubtful relevance. So, I now raise the question, how unequal is the distribution of income in the United States? And there's a lot of confusion about this. The basic problem is that there's no way to summarize it. About the only way that you can usefully, what you could do is you could try lining everybody up and determining their income, and you'd have an enormous computer printout that would have everybody's income on it. But that wouldn't work. You know, I'm looking at Jan Bowman. What's her income? But I think that's irrelevant without mixing it with Walt's income. Now, I'm sure it's pitifully low, but but still, people live in families and people share, so what we do is we've come up with distributions of income for families and distributions of incomes for individuals, unrelated individuals. But that isn't even too good, because an unrelated individual is somebody who either lives alone or lives with somebody to whom he's not related. And today, lots of people are living with people to whom they aren't related and really sharing. Some people who really have a sort of common law marriages almost, but for census purposes, they're classified as individuals living alone, and so what happens is that their reported incomes look a lot worse than their actual incomes. There are real difficulties here, but now, the most commonly cited statistics on the distribution of income are data referring to the quintile distribution of income to families. That is to say, we set up, we divide the families into the poorest fifth, the next poorest fifth, the middle fifth, the second richest, and the richest fifth. And then we ask the question, what percentage of the income going to families goes to families in each of those fifths? And those data, and here's where some of the pro-equality people really turn up the volume, those data have shown an astonishing constancy since the 1930s. I didn't bring the data along, but I think I can recall them from memory pretty well. These are very close to the correct figures. It's something like this. 5% goes to the bottom fifth, 11% to the next fifth, 18% to the middle fifth, 25% to the second top fifth, and the richest fifth of all families gets 41% of the income going to families. Now you see, if it were perfectly equal, it would be 20, 20, 20, 20. So it's 5%, 11%, 18, 25, and 41. And that has been decade after decade, from the 30s, it's been remarkably stable, and our data aren't too good from before that. And a lot of people said, isn't it crazy? All these attempts to redistribute income haven't done a jolly thing. We're not getting anywhere, except that it's not true. Because those data, which are often cited, ignore three very important things you can't ignore. One, taxes. They are income before taxes. And the top fifth pays a heck of a lot more taxes than the bottom fifth. Second thing, it ignores an important and increasingly important form of income for the lower fifth, which is income transfers in kind. It does not take account of food stamps, rent subsidies, or Medicare, Medicaid. Now, that used to not be very important, but that is very important today. It also neglects differences in family size, which you have to take into account, because clearly a given income for a family of 10 is not the same thing as an income for a family of 2. Well, if you make these adjustments, if you adjust the data for taxes, for transfers in kind, in things rather than money, transfers in money are included, and make adjustments for family size, the data compress much more. I didn't bring them along again, but I do remember that for 1972, instead of 5, just take the extremes, instead of 5% and 41%, it was 8% for the bottom fifth and about 32% for the top fifth. Now that's a much more equal distribution of income. In fact, you would be hard-pressed to find a country in the world where the distribution of income is more equal. Now, there are problems here. When I say that, I realize that I've got an out. I can quarrel about the comparability. Somebody in this group is bound to say Sweden. But it isn't that much more equal in Sweden if it is significantly equal at all. Now, can we push it further? Now, what I'm trying to tell you, first of all, here is that we have had some success in reducing inequality in the distribution of income. And people who say we haven't done anything are just looking at misleading data. But how much further can we go? There are limits to how far we can go without at least some radical transformation in the nature of our society, because further equalizing is already running into some problems. It runs into the problem, first of all, of high marginal tax rates at the tails of the distribution. And rich people have a decreasing incentive to go out and earn more income, at least income that can be taxed away from them. And so as they shift their energies into non-taxable activities, they reduce the amount that we can capture from them for redistribution to the bottom. And that's, there's a limit. We're probably approaching that limit in some cases. We're not going to get additional income from the rich by taxing them. We're going to cause the rich to reduce their activities. Take physicians. There's been much complaining about the incomes of physicians, but I just want to point out that an awful lot of physicians, most of the physicians which I know, are already making enough income, and they just would rather take a little more leisure. And if you jack up the tax rates or even make nasty noises toward them, they may decide to take additional leisure. But the same thing is true, ironically, at the bottom end. The marginal tax rate, by which I mean the percentage of any additional earned income that goes to the tax collector, is very high for people at the bottom end of the distribution. And you see, the problem that this creates is that they are therefore encouraged not to earn income. A woman, let's say, living, she's the head of a single parent family, and she has three children, and she's on welfare, and she's offered a job where the income would be sufficient to get her off welfare. Why would she take it? Not necessarily, because after she winds up paying Social Security, and after she winds up making babysitter arrangements and buying the clothing that she needs, then there's still more to come. She may get kicked off Medicaid. Which is for poor. Medicare is for poor.
Medicaid.
Yeah, because that could be a real blow. In fact, that might be considered too big a risk. You know, if you had three kids, and all of a sudden you would suddenly be ineligible for that medical attention that you have been counting on. Now, what that translates into, in economist jargon, is a high tax rate on earned income, which gives people very much less incentive to earn the income. And so as you try to redistribute now from the top to the bottom, you're running into problems at both ends. There is also the problem of disinvestment. Well, let me put it this way. If every person received over his lifetime the same income as every other person, the distribution of income at any time would still be unequal, and quite surprisingly unequal, because people receive lower incomes in their younger years and in their retirement years than they receive in the prime years. So that my income, for example, over my lifetime, you know, goes like this, and most people's does. How much of the observed inequality of in the distribution of income is simply a result of the fact that people and families are of different ages? Well, if we don't pay attention to this problem, what we could wind up doing is redistributing income from people in the prime years to people not in the prime years. With what consequence? With the consequence that we give people less incentive to provide for themselves. If we redistribute income from 45-year-old families to 25-year-old families, we are giving people at the age of 25 less incentive to take those steps which would cause their income to be higher at the age 45. What steps, for example? Doggedness, determination, and discipline that leads to careerism. Now, you may think careerism is a bad thing, but careerism does tend to raise one's income over time. To get in there right after college and start slugging away at some hateful task, in the hope or the belief that eventually the task will become less hateful and at least you will get the big bucks. To do that tends to lead to the big bucks. Now, you say big bucks don't matter. okay, maybe they don't, maybe they shouldn't, but it is a fact that if we start redistributing income from people who have provided for their later years by activity in their earlier years to people who have not so provided, we are going to reduce the incentive to provide. That's going to have some consequences. The other thing that I would mention, that's where the problem that we're running into with the redistribution of income, is people's choice of family size. As we redistribute income to people on the basis of criteria, whatever criteria we choose, as long as we raise those criteria, we are going to make it easier for people who want to live apart to do so. In other words, let me put it bluntly. More generous welfare payments increases the divorce rate. That has been proved. The Seattle income maintenance experiment proved that about as conclusively as anything is going to prove it, to the great shock of the people who conducted the experiment. I know you know that in the last decade or so, we have been conducting very extensive and expensive experiments on income maintenance to see what happens to people who are simply given income to get them out of poverty. One of the results is more divorces. Well, that's not all bad. You know, I'm not sure that a legal decree of divorce in a situation where there has been an actual rupture long ago is a bad thing. But as you raise people's income, you make it possible, make it easier for them, less costly for them to split up, make it less costly for people to live alone. And I think I mentioned this on Wednesday, perhaps the most serious, I think the most serious, significant group which is suffering from a decline, significant decline in its real income, is families headed by women. What's causing that? In part, that's being caused by our system of giving aid to families headed by single women. See the dilemma that we're in there.
Isn't that the reason the divorce rate is up? Social service people tell these girls, if your husband leaves you, you're eligible. If he just stays unemployed, you aren't eligible.
Yeah, although we've been moving away from that. Yeah, that was the case. We used to, the system for the distribution of welfare benefits did and still does to some extent encourage husbands to split or sneak in at night or something. But now I'm thinking not of cases where they say, you can imagine, I love you, darling, but I must go so that you can get your welfare benefits. But cases where the man beats the woman, but they have so little income that she can't leave him. Now, she gets, the welfare system is more generous and she can afford to leave. Both of those cases exist, but.
We got one case in mind right now. A guy in service for 23 years getting adequate retirement benefits, going to law school in Chicago. Supposedly separated from his wife because of geographic distance.
Mm-hmm.
She's receiving aid for dependent children. He comes home weekends.
Well, all right. There are serious problems with what I would call flagrant abuse of the system, and I'd like not to get into those. Maybe we have to talk about them. The question is, how much of it is there? I had hoped to avoid that. What you're describing, I would call flagrant abuse of the system. I do think that most flagrant welfare cheaters are upper middle class people. They're really children of wealthy parents who are on welfare, and college students, college graduates who are on welfare, and just college students who are on welfare. That fries my hide. Because they are competent people who have said, darn it, the system's available, and I'm shrewd enough to find out how it works. It's going to bust the bank. It wasn't intended for them. Well, let me hustle on. Oh, dear me. Now, because I haven't really come to the question yet. Let me ask you this. Suppose that all money incomes were somehow or the other made equal by executive decree. There they are. They're all equal, whatever that means. Would we have equality? If we had equality of income, would we have equality? Well, no, we wouldn't, of course, because there is this difference in family size. If every person received the same income, then large families would be much better off than single individuals or small families. But there are also other factors. How about diversity of tastes and circumstances? A person with a physiological condition, with asthma, let's say, may have to live in a more expensive place in order to attain the same level of satisfaction. A person who derives immense pleasure out of looking at sunsets can get along on far less income than a person who can't derive pleasure from anything less than a Mark IV. Equal clothing, equal shelter is not really equality. Some people have appetites like birds, and some people have enormously high rates of basal metabolism. true equality would require that the people like me with a hyperthyroid condition get lots of the food and little of the clothes. But in addition, money isn't everything. Now, you know that money isn't everything, but in fact, I'm convinced that money isn't very much. Now, sure, ask the rich man, I forget how it goes. Rich people always say money isn't very important. But, if you start thinking about it, an enormous quantity of the want-satisfying goods in our society are produced in the household. And they're never measured by these statistics. I mean, the fact that my wife is a good cook enormously increases our real income, you know, which means our level of satisfaction. And middle-class families and upper-middle-class families tend to be good at processing goods into satisfactions. So that if you made all the monetary incomes equal, you would have, I'm convinced, vastly different levels of satisfaction related to individual and family skills at turning income into real goods. And I think that's very important. We would also discover, I think, if we equalized monetary incomes, we would begin to discover the real importance of other inequalities, which I summarize as inequalities of prestige and power. I got just this much yet, then I can throw it open for discussion. I think that as we move toward the redistribution of income, the elimination of excessive inequalities, but what is a pursuit without a clear criterion, so that it's really moving toward the elimination of any inequalities, we're going to discover that the real inequalities are inequalities of satisfaction. And I can see a lot of evidence of this already in Seattle. Seattle is probably a relatively, quote, liberal city, and maybe it picks these things up faster than a lot of places do in the Midwest. But, New York City, my wife subscribes to the Village Voice, and I read that. And they're already along the point where they're saying, well, you know, it isn't enough to make all incomes equal, because somebody with a disease of some kind deserves additional income in order to handle his disease. We really want equality of satisfaction. That's the only true and morally relevant equality. But you know, this is going to lead inevitably to the social control of behavior. Why? Well, if society is saying, we accept the obligation to make you as well off as your neighbor, and you then light up a cigarette, we say unto you, no, no. We have an obligation to take care of your health, and we're going to make you take care of it. Now, I'm very serious about this, and you can see evidence of it in our society. We are beginning to say, in more and more areas, people may not behave in ways that reduce their future individual welfare, and we justify it by saying, because no man is an island, and no woman either, for that matter. I once got into a long argument with somebody over motorcycle helmet laws. I believe that there should not be compulsion. You've got to wear a motorcycle helmet. I don't believe there should be such laws. But I don't want to, just for purposes of illustration, I don't want to get into the argument. Because I think here, the interest of the state is minimal. The interest of the individual is very, very large. And individuals should have a right to fall off their motorcycle and bounce on their heads. But I can't say, it's not true that when an individual does that, he himself bears the cost and stuff, because society sends an ambulance to pick him up, and he doesn't pay the full cost of that, and he leaves behind weeping family members. And you know, but if you start using this argument, you can't let people do any dumb thing at all. And will we stop, prevent? I think we're going to have to prevent mountain climbing. No, really. In fact, I'm not a mountain climber, and I'm scared to death of heights. And I don't understand why the rest of us should pay money to rescue these idiots who decide to climb a mountain. But we're going to do it. But see, the problem is we're going to do it. When we get there, we're not going to say, all right, you idiot, you got yourself up there, you get yourself down. We're going to be kind, and we're going to send a rescue team. Well, what I'm suggesting is that we are going to move increasingly, as we try to equalize satisfactions in the name of what we think is justice, we're going to move toward the social control of behavior. We're not going to allow people to do things that may in the future reduce their satisfaction, because if you do reduce your satisfaction, the rest of us are going to have to pay for it. Now,
we made prohibition once, but that is one of the places where it cuts down on inequality.
Ingmar Bergman is another one. This fellow in Sweden, he left Sweden, the great...
Well, but of course, I think he left because he claimed he was just being hassled by the tax authorities.
Well, that's right, but it was the idea that...
Yeah, but I'm really raising a question beyond that, where we don't claim that we want to get it away from you. We want to say we want to take care of you. We want to keep you from getting yourself in trouble. Yeah.
This is something where you're at now, where I've been struggling for quite some time. When I was going to seminary, I had a job that I would go around cleaning and fixing furnaces in Minneapolis for welfare, well, really the slum landlord kind of situation, but the city paid for the furnace to be cleaned. And I'd go into these places and see clothes that had been purchased or given to them stacked in one corner of the basement, as high as the basement, for 30 feet long, that had been worn once and thrown right next to a perfectly good set of washer and dryer that had never been used. And it really bothered me that there's something very important that's missing here.
You're calling attention. An illustration of the problem that I like is that, do you know that there are a number of reasons why people don't get medical care, or what most of us would consider adequate medical care. One is they don't have income, but another is they just don't want to. There are people who give, you can give, for example, some women, pregnant women, you can say, it's free, just go to the clinic. Then they'll say, I haven't got transportation. Provide transportation. They'll say, I haven't got a babysitter. Provide a babysitter. They will not be there when you come with the babysitter and the van. Why? They don't want to go. Why? Well, I don't want to, I don't like to go to doctors and I don't like to go to dentists. And what I'm doing is postponing it because it doesn't hurt yet. And what I'm suggesting is that we're moving toward a society where everyone will be required to visit the dentist twice a year. Can I, I want to say just, Kurt, do you want to? Okay. I want to raise the, this is the big question, but now I got to balance it with another big question. If we are going to be taking this kind of care of one another, or you call it snooping and prying, or where do we stop? What do you have a right to do to me? Is there no privacy? Don't I have any right to? Shouldn't we extend this into culture too? We all know that the real important wants are spiritual wants, and I mean spiritual in the broad sense. Aren't we going to have to see to it that people read good poetry so that they broaden themselves and develop? Otherwise, we talk like a bunch of crass materialists. We think if we give people food and fill up the holes in their teeth, then they're well off. But life is really a matter of learning to want the better things. Now the question is, where do we stop? There's got to be some point, isn't there, where we stop? But I don't see how we can decide where to stop unless we ask the question, what are our obligations to one another? And where do they end? What do we owe one another by virtue of living in this society together? Now, some of my libertarian friends say that question would never have come up if you had respected the principle of liberty. If you had just stuck with the traditional old American view that every individual should have a right to do what he pleases and should be required to bear the consequence of doing what he pleases, as long, of course, as he grants everybody else a similar right. Now, the trouble with that argument is, and it's sometimes put very neatly as, you're free to swing your fist, but your freedom stops where my nose begins. That's a neat way of putting it, because it reveals the problem. Where does your nose have a right to be?
Yeah.
Yeah. You see, the libertarians, the people who say all this is solved if we accept the simple and natural principle of liberty, are forgetting that liberty only works when we have already agreed on what it is that people have a right to be free to do. You know, and you say, well, I don't have a right to take anything away from you. That's not true. I do have a right to take things away from you in certain situations. I have a right to set up a 7-Eleven store two blocks from yours and take your customers away from you. there are rights that, their interests conflict. And the thing is, now here's, come to the, this is the last sentence I will state. Probably will be a long one. Both liberty and equality, or justice, presuppose a kind of moral consensus, an agreement on what it is that we owe to one another, what our obligations are to one another. And I find it interesting that on Bastille Day, I can tell you that the problems of equality and liberty cannot be solved unless we face the fundamental problem of sorority. Liberty, equality, and sorority. Those were the three. All right, Friday. Enough fun. Liberty, equality, and fraternity were the three slogans of the French Revolution. And a lot of people have thought, and I myself used to think, that they were in conflict. And I think that they inform one another. And that question of fraternity or sorority, what are our fraternal obligations, how far do they reach, is fundamental. And we've got to get thinking about it and talking about it, and that's going to be tough, because we are living in a society which at the one and the same time preaches everybody's got a right to do his own thing, and nobody's got a right to do anything that interferes with anybody else. And that's begging the question on both ends. Amen. Okay, great.
Well, I guess I get terribly frightened when I think about the people that are going to be making these decisions for me. And one thing that bothers me is everyone would have to agree that some redistribution of income and wealth is necessary. We live in a wealthy country, and we want people to, you know, achieve some relatively good way of living. But I think we're seeing an increasing emphasis on elimination of risk, the possibility of eliminating risk taking. And this is a big hang up I have. You talk about doggedness and all this stuff. Also, at that age, being willing to take risks. I don't think we can afford in this country, a country that was built by people who took risks, to eliminate this incentive. There's got to be a relationship between risk and return in this country, or we're taking away something that has served us well. And we can see this, for example, when the government talks about capital gains treatment, oil depletion allowances, or all naughty, nasty, rich people schemes. But let us not forget that those are incentives for private investment, and we're talking about not only just the rich people, we're talking about middle-income people hold up a lot of stock in this country. We've got to retain that, or we're going to lose some flavor, something that's exciting about this country. And keep in mind that if there isn't an incentive for you to invest in an apartment building or in some stock or something like this, who is going to do this investment? The building has got to be built. People do need homes. The government is going to step in and do it for me. God forbid. Mm-hmm. I don't want the government doing that for me. I'd rather have a vehicle for doing it myself. And not everybody that has investment capital makes $1 million every time they invest something. Anybody that's had investment experience knows you lose and you win and you hope the government helps you along a little bit, but you want to keep going into the next plunge. So that's just I'll say amen on that.
I
think we've got to be very conscious of that, and this leveling and so forth. I think we're going to be missing something that's important in our lives.
Yeah, but notice what that would require. It would require, and I would extend it beyond. I think it's important not to just focus on the investment of money in apartment buildings or stocks and so on, but recognize that all of life is risky. And people take risks by going to school, by getting married, by having children. An awful lot of risks ought to be taken. And a society which insures people against the consequences of their choices is shifting the responsibility for choices in ways that are going to alter behavior. I would not, in fact, though I don't climb mountains, I would not be in favor of forbidding mountain climbing. Because I think that there's an activity that functions in a strange way for all of us, and we ought to pick up the tab. But it's a function that encourages kind of risky living. All I'm suggesting is that the principle is a very broad one and shouldn't be confined to monetary.
Okay, we're talking about the redistribution of wealth.
Yeah.
Social Security has taken away from our ability during our peak years to put away money for our care in our latter declining years. That has distributed income,
redistributed income
tremendously from robbing Peter to pay Paul. The person who is now earning is not putting his money in the government for his own retirement, but for the retirement of people who have not put into the system.
Yeah.
You recall some years ago the Townsend system where they were going to give so many people $200 or $300 a month, and they had to show receipts that was all spent before they could get their next.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain that by any way and make it more detailed to some of these people that don't remember that?
Well, no, since it fizzled out, I don't. I'd rather not. I don't know that much about it. You probably know more about it than I do, but it was one of our earlier gung-ho experiments rooted in California, wasn't it?
Our friend from North Dakota, too. What was his name?
Townsend plant? Wasn't that originally in California?
Yeah. Townsend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was from North Dakota.
Was he? Yeah.
I've always thought that maybe one of the best ways that we could equalize the income would be to take away several of the many tax systems that we have and settle on a very basic sales tax. Excuse me, that's the most fair tax. Reach everyone.
You raised the question of the tax system, and it's an important one. A lot of people protest about the high tax rates on capital gains and risk-taking activities, and other people complain about the loopholes. And it's kind of interesting to watch the term loopholes. A loophole is the concept of loopholes presupposes either that Congress didn't know what they were doing, or that the government owns all your income and they allow you to take some. There's a term now, it's very kind of tax expenditures. Have you heard run across the term tax expenditures? Tax expenditure means simply income that is not taxed. And it presupposes that the government has a right to all your income, and any that they allow you to keep is a tax expenditure or a loophole. I think we've got to be careful about what loopholes are. Sometimes people find ways to dodge through the tax system which Congress didn't intend, but Congress tends to close those pretty fast. But I don't think, for example, that the tax breaks that homeowners get is a loophole at all. This represents a conscious policy to promote homeownership as a part of good social policy. And I happen to think it's a good, quote, loophole. But as for the sales tax, I think it would be useful for us to evaluate a sales tax as a good tax. Exempt food from a sales tax, and the sales tax ceases to be regressive. it becomes a slightly progressive tax. And you can put in some additional exemptions. And one of the virtues of a sales tax, but I would abolish income taxes and taxes on business of every kind, just focus on a sales tax, is that it taxes people in those activities which are really costly to other members of the society. It is not my earning of income that costs you. What costs you is my taking away from the pile of goods. And if indeed we are interested in encouraging responsible use of resources and conservation, all that sales tax makes a lot of sense.
I wonder if you could borrow any ideas from Marxism.
Borrow any ideas from Marxism? Whether I would or we should or from?
No, in terms of equal distribution of income.
It's very difficult to borrow ideas from Marxism. Other than ideas critical of the capitalist system, because Marx didn't write a whole lot about the future socialist society, about the kind of society he wanted. More and more Marxian documents are being translated and published all the time, and the Marx Engels Institute has now promised that by the end of the century, a lot of Marxist colleagues at the University of Washington. None of them in the economics department. Economics is an anecdote, but I can't find any two of them to agree on what we could learn from Marxism. You know, there are Yugoslav preferers and communist Chinese preferers and others who say only Cuba is the true form, and hiding around somewhere, I'm sure, is an old-fashioned Stalinist. Marx was basically a critic of capitalism. And a critic of 19th century capitalism. He had the disadvantage of not having seen 20th century capitalism.
His idea of state being the coordinator of equal distribution.
Yeah, but that some people say that's not really Marx's idea.
I mean, it is Lenin actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Paul?
Mm-hmm.
An interesting statistic in this regard involving Russia, I think we've perhaps all heard it, where in an attempt for equal distribution in a communist system, large farms populated by farmers, each family is given an equivalent of an acre or something of this kind to do with what they want. And it turns out that 1% of the agricultural land in Russia is producing something like 27% of the global food product through the incentive system.
Yeah, yeah, those figures are often pointed to. See, when you point out that maybe inequalities of income are necessary to provide people incentive to perform useful social tasks, people will come back with the argument, well, that's only true in a society in which they've been socialized to be competitive and individualistic and selfish. Well, the Soviet Union has had over 50 years now to de-socialize those people. They don't seem to have been very successful. But if I say that to my socialist or Marxist friends, they say, well, the Soviet Union isn't real socialism. And I say, well, okay, what is real socialism? And then they will say, well, you know, then they start giving other examples. But then I go back to the question, but why isn't the Soviet Union real socialism? They say, well, that's an aberration, but I want to know why that aberration occurred. I think that if we want to learn lessons from socialist countries or from capitalist countries, we've got to be careful that we don't discriminate in which lessons we learn. You know, we've got to be careful that we don't only look at the lessons that drive home our point and fail to look at the lessons which contradict our point. But in general, I think that while cross-cultural comparisons can be instructive, they ought to be used with extreme care. There are special factors operating in the Soviet Union that don't operate in this country, just as there are factors operating in Sweden that aren't operative in this country. I think we can get hints and hunches, but be careful about drawing conclusions about what's possible and what's not possible on the basis of the experience of another country. That's an awfully vague and sloppy note on which to conclude. Mm-hmm. But so let me just urge you, as you go out to the coffee bell, to be thinking about this question: what do you owe other people in the United States? And if you say, gee, but I owe obligations to people in the world, in the whole world, the world is my master. Well, you might remember that the people to whom your obligations are most effective and important are the members of your immediate family. And, you know, the broader your vision, sometimes, the more ineffective your grasp. It's nice to think big, but don't think so big that you don't get anything done. Don't love humanity so intensely that you have no time for the person who sits next to you on the bus. On the other hand, don't become so preoccupied with the person who sits next to you on the bus that he moves.